Good afternoon. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU FM. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change here in the Dawnland. We explore topics such as restorative justice, restorative practices, decolonization, cultural revival, and more. Our guests are people involved in aspects of truth, healing, and change work. This program is offered in an effort to share, inspire, and inform. Dawnland Signals is a collaboration of WERU-FM and Wabanaki Reach.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon. My name is Esther Ann, and you're on Dawnland Signals today. We're really excited to be exploring the topic of Wabanaki authors, and we're so excited to have with us in the studio, or the studio, I wish, right? We're still recording from Zoom. Have with us today.
In our personal studios.
Yeah, visiting virtually in our virtual studio. three guests with us talking about their journey as writers. As we were saying before, that a lot of people say that they'd like to write a book, and you know, we tell people, oh, you should write a book. You should, you know, even on when I see some people on Facebook and how they chronicle their day and they talk about their day. There's a couple elders who I follow that I just love the way they write. I'm like, you should write a book. So I'm so happy that we have really important special guests with us today. But before we get started, Maria is going to do a land appreciation for us.
Thanks, Esther. Yes, before we delve into the discussion and introduce our special guest, let's just pause. Let's just take a moment to acknowledge the land beneath our feet. Wabanakik, the land of the first light, the dawn land. Land that has known Wabanaki ancestors, the tallest trees, and the oldest rivers. Land that has known peace and conflict. Land that has nourished us and sustained us since time immemorial. We acknowledge the indigenous peoples of this land, Wabanakik, the Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, and Abenaki, and we give thanks to your stewardship and resilience. We are broadcasting from WERU Studio in Blue Hill, Alamoosuc, Wabanakik.
Holy one, Maria. So I'm excited today to sit here. We've been visiting for a while, so that's why I sound so enthusiastic. To have with us today virtually visiting is Morgan Talty from Penobscot Nation. And we have Suzanne Greenlaw, Maliseet Nation, and Gabe Frey from Passamaquoddy Nation here. And Gabe and Suzanne co-authored a book. And Morgan is an author of the book, and I'm so excited about their books and where, like Maria said, wherever the conversation takes us. Welcome. Morgan, would you introduce yourself more and tell everyone about you?
Yeah, thank you for having me, and I'm glad to be a part of this with Suzanne and Gabe. Yeah, so writing, I mean, I guess I would call myself a writer. that's my primary, I guess, passion and sort of, can you hear me? Okay. So yeah, writing is, I have a book coming out, a story collection called Night of the Living Rez. And it's supposed to come out in the fall of 2022. And it's a story collection. There's 12 stories in it, and it is composed of the same narrator at different times of his life. And in many ways, it sort of can be read as like a novel, but I tried to stay true to the story form. So yeah, I've been writing for, I want to say, about 12 years now. I think seriously, though, I've been writing seriously for probably the past 6 years. So I'm happy to be here and talk about writing and all things related to it.
Welcome, Morgan. Gabe and Suzanne, would you like to introduce yourselves?
Yeah. I'm Gabriel Frey, Passamaquoddy basket maker. I would not describe myself as a writer. Storyteller, but definitely not. I'm very, very new to the form of writing. I guess mostly artist in the three-dimensional sense.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Greenlaw. Maria, I really appreciated your land appreciations statement. I feel like it felt really grounding. I feel like we hear a lot of land acknowledgements that are done by non-Native people acknowledging a past and stuff like that. And it's really nice to hear the land appreciation from a Native perspective. Thank you so much.
I agree.
Thanks for acknowledging the acknowledgement.
Yeah, thank you, Maria.
Yeah. I feel a little nervous, and I felt like, felt really grounding and kind of helped to take away some of my nerves. it was nice. So I am a PhD candidate in the School of Forest Resources. I write a lot of in academic settings and that sort of writing, and this is my first time actually writing fiction. So for us, we are beginner writers, we'll say, but we definitely got bitten after our first kids book. We've seen the process and going through that journey together was really wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it wasn't so wonderful between the two of us, right? It can create a little friction, but.
I guess where the creativity lies, yeah. That in that sort of like loving friction.
But yeah, so we are first time children's books authors.
And did you want to share what the name of your book is?
Yes, thank you. we wrote
The First Blade of Sweet Grass, which comes from the sort of philosophy of the honorable harvest. If you don't pick the first blade of sweet grass that you see, you'll never pick the last.
I like that.
That's beautiful.
Very much. So who would love to tell us what it was that first inspired you to want to write and author the story that you did? Do you want to begin, Morgan?
Yeah, I don't know what inspired me. I think it was maybe stubbornness, because writing is such like a hard, I don't want to say a hard thing, but it's like a very big commitment, as is any sort of dedication to art. This particular book, I feel like I always tell writers, like, you're going, when you start writing, like, you're going to write so much stuff that isn't like publishable, right? Like, it's like you're really, you know, figuring yourself out. And a lot of people despair over that fact, that they may have written, you know, so many bad pieces. But I don't look at it that way. I look at all those failed stories as just footsteps towards what I'm eventually going to write. So this book that's coming out, Night of the Living Res, I feel like is a product of everything I've sort of wrote, you know, since I started writing when I was 18, you know, those very bad first sentences. And figuring the book out was its own process and its own sort of fun thing. But I don't know, I've always sort of felt like, you know, Gabe, you had said you wouldn't call yourself a writer, but you'd say you were a storyteller. It's like, I always felt like a storyteller. I always loved telling stories. I always loved how those stories affected people. And when I was younger, I always told stories. I remember even in second grade, getting not in trouble, but having during parent-teacher conference, the teacher saying, I spun a lot of tales, I guess, or something. But the funny thing was, is a lot of them were like grounded in like truth. Like, I had told my teacher I worked for a moving company, but I really didn't. But my dad owned one, and I like would work for it in the summertime when I was little. So I'd always sort of enjoyed telling stories. And I think the first time I ever actually tried to write a story was not even my own. It was, I had a bootlegged copy of Lord of the Rings, the first one that came out, and the quality was so bad that it irritated me. So I was like, I'm going to write this. And I remember copying like the word from word that I only got like 15 pages in. And I remember like changing dialogue and stuff and then taking it in sort of my own direction. But I just always really liked telling stories, and the best career, I guess, in today's world is, you know, to be a writer, you know, to write novels or fiction or nonfiction. So I guess it's just sort of in my nature to gravitate toward that.
I love that you both have mentioned storytelling. And when Gabe first said, you know, a storyteller, maybe, but not, you know, not necessarily considering myself a writer, but, you know, that does seem like the natural progression, because we know that storytelling was so prevalent in Native cultures. And, you know, not only just, you know, for entertainment, but, you know, guiding us in how to be with one another and the earth, and guiding us in you know, the transmission of intergenerational knowledge and all of that. So storytelling is such a strong cultural aspect to our, I'm sorry, I get distracted. Anyway, I won't go on and on, but only that really jumped out at me when you were saying storytelling, that I loved that connection and this being a new form of writing. So,
can everybody hear me? This is Esther.
Yeah.
Yep. I had some internet issues, so I apologize, but I had to join by phone, so I can't see you.
Just recap.
When I hear of storytelling, I think of Golisgub, of course, because, you know, that's, you know, story, that's what the storyteller means, right? Golusk. And even when I was a kid, they would use it as a, my parents would use it as a, like, if you, they thought you were telling stories, or like in a negative way, like making things up, they'd say, Akwi Golusk, you know, stop telling stories. So I always think of, that's how I think of Golusgub, as the storyteller. And those stories are so important.
Gabe or Suzanne, did you want to share what inspired you to write the first blade of Sweetgrass? I think you have already a little bit, you know, in making that connection to the honorable harvest. But yeah, like, when did you finally say, oh, we're gonna do this?
Well, we didn't seek out to be writers initially. It was not something that was on our radar to attempt to do. But so I do. Part of my research is working in Acadia National Park to restore Wabanaki sweetgrass gathering. And that research was featured in the Bangor Daily, I think, in 2018. And an editor reached out to me from that article and asked if I was interested in writing a children's book, or if there was a children's book in the story. And so I was somewhat like surprised, because it was not, I've never really, even though people say they want to write a book, like how to do it, and actually, it just seems such a far off dream, you know, to actually be attainable. And then here was a bridge to do it. And somebody saying like,
will you do this?
Yeah. So that was our first step. And then, so I wanted to include Gabe, because I really like working with my husband more than just my husband, but I love our interplay and the conversation between us. And I just really like collaboration. And so I said, Gabe, what do you think? Do you think there's a story here? And I had just spent 3 years with sweetgrass gatherers, hearing their stories. And Gabe's mom, Gal, is this amazing sweetgrass gatherer, has been doing it since was 10. So she had, you're just hearing her stories were amazing. And also we have two children. One now is 7 and the other one's 4. So we've been reading a lot of children's books. And just really searching for some Wabanaki, like authentic Wabanaki children's books was challenging, yeah. Right? There's a handful of them out there and they're wonderful, but we want more, we wanted more. And so, and also more around our ethics of harvesting and more of our relationship with the landscape. We really felt limited in trying to find stories about, you know, about that aspect of our culture. So we saw all of this sort of opportunity to address, to create a book of things that we thought were missing, or things that we wanted to read to our children. And so that was really the push, the impetus to start putting it down on paper.
This is Esther. I'm so appreciative that you did, because it's so important for you know, our children to see themselves and their ways of being and their worldview represented in that way in those books and have it so easily accessible to them. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU. I'm your co-host, Esther Ann, along with Maria Gerard. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. Today, we are talking about, well, we started talking about writing, but we're really talking about storytelling with Suzanne Greenlaw and Gabe Frey and Morgan Talty, all Wabanaki authors. So in thinking about storytelling, I can't help but think about reading and what you like to read and who your favorite authors are. Morgan, do you want to share?
Yeah, that's a tough question, who my favorite authors are. I feel like I have a lot of favorite authors. I think when I think of Indigenous writers, I love Louise Erdrich. I love James Welch's work. More contemporaneously, Tommy Orange's There is a good book. Who else? Toni Jensen's Carrie, which is a memoir, is very good. Crooked Hallelujah by Kelly Jo Ford. I love Richard Van Camp's work. He is a First Nations writer. He's written tons of children's books, and I think his most popular work is called The Lesser Blessed. It's like a novella. It was also turned into a film. It's really, really good. So I love all of those. I also love sort of, I guess, American writers like Dennis Johnson and Otessa Moshfegh. Anybody who writes stuff that is realistic and tends to really highlight both the good, the bad, and the messy in between of what it is to be human. Those are the types of works that I tend to gravitate towards.
Yeah, I just finished There by Tommy Orange, and my heart was beating so fast at the end. I haven't been able to read another book since. I recommend that book to people too. And I love Louise Erdrich as well. And I was thinking, Gabe and Suzanne, when you're talking about you wrote a children's book. So who are your favorite children's book authors? No. Who are your daughter's favorite authors?
Well, actually, she just told me that they're doing, because she's in first grade, and they're practicing writing, which has been a journey for her. You know, like she wasn't her favorite subject, we'll say that.
Yeah.
So she just told me that she chose The Water Protector and is doing a book report on that one. I'm not sure if you guys have actually, we forget the audience.
I know, right?
The Water Protector was illustrated by Michaela Goad. She just won an award for Indigenous illustrations, children books illustrations.
Yeah,
but she's the first Indigenous illustrator to win that award.
Incredible artist. She did also I Sang You Down from the Stars, which is such a beautiful, it's a beautiful story. But the way I feel like so much of children's books is told through the illustrations. It's so beautiful. It's her work.
So we were like,
I was just.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry to interrupt. No, go. Please continue.
We're just trying to find we're trying to make connections. We're trying to find as many Indigenous illustrators and writers and kind of build up that those people we look to for inspiration and advice through their writing. I feel like their writing can give me advice or give us advice on how to move forward.
Great. I was just going to say that hearing all these great authors and books, we probably could put together a little resource list and have it included with the archives of this program. There's some that I hadn't heard of before, so I appreciate it.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, speaking of advice, I wondered if, you know, like Esther was saying at the beginning of the program, so many people have it in them that they really want to, you know, write a book. You know, I can't count how many people I've said about that, even most particularly about one's memoirs. But what sort of advice would you have for aspiring authors and particularly Native authors? Because one thing that you said, Suzanne, really perked up my ears when you said authentic Wabanaki children's books. So any advice that you'd like to hand down?
I think
whoever wants to jump in.
Go ahead, Morgan.
I think for anybody who wants to, especially Native, young Native people or Native people in general at any age, if they want to write a book, if they want to tell a story, I feel like one of the first steps to do is to reach out to an artist that is in their community that does, you know, what they may want to do. I think to be an artist is to want to help other artists. Like, that's sort of my main belief. And, you know, like, I'm constantly talking with writers who have reached out and, you know, where do I start? You know, how do I, you know, what is the best way to go about doing this? Another thing too is a lot of people think of wanting to write a book, like that comes to mind first. And, you know, we were talking about storytelling, and storytelling precedes the book. Storytelling doesn't really have a genre associated with it. It's, you know, we put a genre to it. So consider, you know, like, what is it that you want to write a book? You know, is it you want to write a, you know, poetry collection? Do you want to write, you know, a script? You know, like, how do you want to tell your story? And start really reading widely, right? Like, checking out things that may be similar to what you want to do. You really sort of need that roadmap. And there's a lot you can learn from reading books. Like, they tell you how they work. I think Suzanne had mentioned something like that. Like, you know, you read these books and they tell you, or they're instructive in some way about how they work, and how to write them. So my advice is to do that. There's also, you know, classes you can take, creative writing classes. There's programs, you know, degree programs you can pursue. And yeah, I think there are a lot of different ways to go about writing a book. If there was one answer I would give it, I think there are tons of ways you can go about it, right? You know, like Suzanne and Gabe, you guys had mentioned not really planning on ever writing a book, right? You're a PhD, PhD student, and you've been writing in academia for a while, and then an editor approached you, and then it sort of changed this whole dynamic, and you're like, wait, maybe we could tell this story. And so these moments, I think, present themselves at certain points in our life. And you may not want to write a book yet, but a time may come where you will have no choice but to write one, or to tell a story. So really just reach out to people, read, and really don't let that desire to tell a story die. That's what's very important.
Yeah, I think that's really great advice. It's sort of like the whole sort of approaching it from telling a story. And I think for us, it was that sort of desire to have a story that we've wanted to hear be told, I guess. And really going from that and just figuring out, like, what, from our experience, what was that story and finding it?
This is Esther. It's really so powerful to think about how you are all impacting and changing, you know, directing the narrative and correcting it, I guess, and writing, almost writing, filling gaps and repairing some harms almost that we're so invisible, right? And there is misrepresentation of us as well. So to have that word, I guess Maria mentioned, reiterated what Suzanne said, authentic, you know, representation is really important. And I think I listened to Morgan talk about just, you know, keep reading and keep writing. And my mom passed away 3 years ago, and she was quite a poet and a writer. And I have a stack of her writings. And I always used to tell her, you know, am I going to have to wait till you pass away before I'm able to print these? And before she got sick, she started thinking about, she really wanted to publish them. She had this desire. So I'm hoping to figure out, my family's hoping to figure out how to publish her write-ins even now that she's passed, because I have them all here on hard copy.
Well, that's awesome. I hope that you do that. I've read some of her writings that you've shared, and it's very, very powerful. Not only that, but, you know, really grounded in our history. So you're able to, you know, in her description of place, it like takes you right back there.
Yeah, I feel like for us in the work we do, it's important that we create authentic representation. But also that people, Wabanaki people, can feel pride in our form of knowledge, right? I feel like there is this historical approach that, you know, that diminishes Native sciences, Native knowledge, Native ways of being. I've said this to other people, but like when you look at basket makers, some of the past writings would call basket makers peddlers. Right. When you actually look at other people writing about Native people, it's usually in this diminutive form of practice.
Yeah.
Instead of actually, this practice has so much knowledge and information and just generations and generations of wisdom that it extends into a practice that is sustainable, that we can do this over and over in the same place. That's an example of a sustainable practice that Western approaches struggle to maintain, right? Like, but oftentimes that practice is seen as anecdotal, not really a form of knowledge, not a practice because it doesn't use the correct language of science. And so we saw this, or I saw this as an opportunity to use the way that we talk about our knowledge and sciences, but in a way that wasn't removed from the culture, didn't feel alien, you know, of the way maybe Western science may talk about sort of science and sort of talk about our sustainable practice and how that practice extends from our ethics and our belief systems, right? So so that when people say this, that, you know, we don't really want to teach people how to pick something or how to harvest something. Usually we get asked like, how do you do that? How do you cut down that tree, or how do you pick sweetgrass? And Native people tend to get really vague when that happens. They're like, oh, you know, over there. Like they get super
vague.
Where
do you find ash? Yeah. Oh, it's in the woods.
Yeah, yeah. Like those are tools that we to deflect. Those are deflecting tools, right? But what people do want to teach or talk about is our value system and ethics in our
philosophy embedded within the teachings.
And we wanted that to be highlighted in this children's book, in that story between a grandmother and a grandchild.
You said, Gabe, that children's book is a lot about the illustrations, the stories are told in the illustrations.
Yeah.
And can you talk about the illustration in your book? And you know, who did it? And
Yeah.
It's funny.
So it's an interesting aspect of the story, because there there was a little bit of translating the story. And I think that gets back to authentic Native voice, because it was a non-Indigenous illustrator she's an incredible artist when it comes to landscapes and sort of storytelling through that aspect. But there was a significant learning curve about describing Indigenous culture and what to share and what not to share, because like it's this. The artist is Nancy Baker. But the story itself is sort of this really sort of like intimate relationship with this grandmother and this grandchild, and the other character in the story is Saltmarsh, the landscape.
And this process was definitely a learning curve for us. And so we learned the process of creating a kid's book. Once we wrote the story, we actually wrote the story about 2.5 years ago, I think. So, and then it got kind of put into the machine of like the editor engaging with the illustrator. And so it was an interesting process of how to convey an Indigenous philosophy to a non-Native illustrator. But we worked together, and there's a lot of emails being passed back and forth, and we feel really happy with the results, and that the illustrator she does these amazing landscapes. You can really feel like you're in the Saltmarsh and the beauty of the Saltmarsh, and because it's not a hospitable location to spend time in.
It really isn't.
It's not like
if you've ever harvested sweetgrass, but the images are very inviting and but very once, sort of like.
I do feel like once you settle into it, you can then appreciate the beauty. If you get over this, maybe the smell and the amount of mosquitoes that are trying to attack you, you then can learn to love the landscape. And I feel like the illustrator really captured that beauty resides there, that is inherent in that landscape. It's really interesting. Yeah.
I love hearing all the inner workings of this book coming together, and producing this beautiful product. And also, really resonated with my ears to hear, that you wanted Wabanaki people to feel pride and how important it is for them to see themselves represented in the literature. And to start that, at such a young, early age, that's really groundbreaking. And I know there's been some other Wabanaki authors that have done the same, including Alan Sockerbase, and with his Thanks to the Animals children's book. Really nice. So anyway, I wanted to switch gears a little bit. And first, I want to do a station identification. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU-FM. I am your co-host, Maria Gerard, along with co-host Esther Ann. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. And today, we are talking with Wabanaki authors Morgan Tulte, Gabe Frey, and Suzanne Greenlaw. I wondered, Morgan, if you wanted to share with us anything that you are currently writing or working on.
Yeah, I feel like I go through two stages. One where I'm like working/not working on a bunch of tiny little things, or like dipping my feet back into a project, or I am like in a state of complete total absorption in something that I'm writing. Right now I'm in the first thing I mentioned. I'm sort of just like working on stories here and there, and magazines have started to ask me to like submit pieces and stuff. So I have like deadlines for that. That I do. But on a large scale, I have my book coming out, and I'm also working on revising a novel. In the midst, because I haven't worked on it for a while, but I've been drafting a new novel about a family, a mother who has lost custody of her children for like what may be the final time. And the book is called The Year of the Frog Clan. And it's this family that's like trying to come back together for like the first time in their life. You know, the mother has had substance abuse issues and the children live with their aunt, and it's there's a lot of humor in it, but it is about substance abuse. I'm very drawn to narratives that deal with that. So that's my newest like project I'm working on. And I've been wanting to write like an indigenous zombie book. I have not started. I wrote a story about a story kind of like based on like zombies. There's no zombies in it. It's about a guy who's sort of, he thinks the end is coming, and it's a very dark story, but I guess that was my way of sort of testing the waters with that. But yeah, I have been wanting to write like a zombie narrative futuristic thing. So yeah, I don't know if I'll get it. I don't know when I'll get around to it, but those are the things I'm sort of working on right now, sort of scattered all over the place.
Morgan, have you read The Last Powwow by that Native Thomas?
No, I haven't.
It's sort of like, it's not a zombie book, but it's contemporary concepts told through a Native lens, and it's this one continuous story, but all of these different stories interwoven. That sort of like writing always excites me, when you see like contemporary sort of concepts told through a Native lens. That's sort of like, I would be super excited to read a Native zombie apocalypse story.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I thought, I just, thank you for that suggestion. I just opened it in a browser now, so now I can find it. Yeah, I've been like, I wanted to like write the zombie narrative set like 400 years in the future, where like indigenous people, or at least like indigenous people in Maine, have sort of like reclaimed their land, and it's like sovereign, you know what I mean? And it's like, they're like subsisting and living and like thriving. But nobody for like 200 years has left that area. So they don't really know what else is like, what the world looks like. And they don't know if it's over yet. And I'm like, what if I sent like a group of Native people out to go, you know, like what would happen, right? Like, what would the landscape look like? Like how bad would the idea of like Western capitalism ruined, you know, everybody's attempt at surviving. Whereas, you know, traditional values in a tribe may have made them, you know, able to survive for those 400 years. And I always come back to the island as a setting, because it's an island, right? And it's like,
yeah,
completely cut off, right? And unless zombies could swim, I don't know. It could be a great place to set the story.
Yeah, according to The Walking Dead, that's perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Well, yeah, that's like such an exciting sort of concept. The idea of like taking like the you know, capitalism, this complete separation of your environment, and then following that through to its logical conclusion, and then an indigenous perspective of like connection with the land and your environment, and following that through, and then seeing where they collide 200 years later. That's fascinating.
Yeah, because I was thinking of like, because you brought up The Walking Dead, and in The Walking Dead, it's like everybody's fighting for resources, you know what I mean? And I read this book, The Moon of the Crusted Snow, by Rice. I can't remember his first name. He's a First Nations author, but it's sort of this like apocalyptic book, and it's a Native community in Canada, and they lose communication with the outside world, and something strange is happening. And there's this white guy who shows up, and everybody who sort of starts to show up, they don't mind sharing the resources with them. And it was completely like different ideology than if like, I don't know, like Bangor fell, or, you know, some other city, you know, they'd be like, get out of here, this is our stuff, you know what I mean? So like, that's what I was thinking about, is like this idea of sharing, this idea of, you know, how far it can actually take you. And I mean, The Walking Dead, if anyone's ever seen it, who's listening, you know, that is like, that's how they survive, yet they half the time miss it. They don't see it. So yeah, that's, I guess I'm maybe rambling a bit here, but it would be super cool to see a story like that.
Yeah.
Well, it all sounds so exciting. And I know I, for one, will be looking forward to the Year of the Frog Clan. It sounds really powerful work. I wanted to just ask the same question of Suzanne and Gabe, if there's any projects that you're currently working on right now.
Well, it's funny. After we wrote that book, we're like, oh, and what about this aspect of our culture? And what about this sort of teaching? And we sort of like came up with, I don't even know, like four or five
more ideas
that are sort of like just being fleshed out because there are aspects of the culture that you can tell from a child's perspective and, you know, in that process of learning different things.
We have one draft that is done and we're actually trying to teach ourselves and attempt to illustrate it ourselves or Gabe is. And so, before we submit it, we're going to try to get together five illustrations with the draft, to show what we see the illustrations being. Yeah. Our first book, we really saw it as a learning process. It was a vehicle for us to like open the door to see the world of publishing and illustrations and that relationship. And now we're learning about marketing a little bit more and how that all works. But we're really just newbies in the whole process. And so now for our second attempt, we're going to try to do more of it ourselves.
Yeah. So the second one is a little boy learning to sort of accept a changing family through the story of Apu Dumkin, the water serpent, who sort of like changes his environment and it sort of works out for the better.
Yeah.
So many great possibilities when, related to our cultural and traditional stories. I always love the story of the frog monster.
Right.
So, go ahead.
Well, some people have suggested, some non-native people thought it'd be really great to tell a traditional story. And we always try to say, yeah, we love our traditional stories, but we don't want to publish a traditional story. Mm. We want to use that as a metaphor or something for a
starting off point.
Yeah. Starting off point for kids today of how they can relate that to their own life. I feel like that is more of a native perspective, right? Where the grandfather is telling the grandson about a traditional story where that grandson can then use that to inform his own life.
Yeah. Because oftentimes that's sort of like our traditional stories don't belong to us. They're sort of tools that we use.
Right.
They're gifts from our ancestors, but then to incorporate that and those traditional lessons into a story that then can be sort of placed in today's world. Yeah.
Yeah. So many great lessons embedded in our traditional stories. The one that I always seem to notice the most is about not being greedy. You know, that seems to come up time and time again in our stories. And I had once learned that for traditional Penobscot society to be greedy was like considered the most egregious offense anyone could perpetrate against their community. So lots of lessons about greed.
Yeah, I love that. I was just listening to this podcast and a woman was talking about the different perspectives and how kids learn, that most of Indigenous stories are about how to get along with each other.
Yeah.
You know, those kind of values and ethics. And a lot of Western stories are how to be first.
Yeah, how to become king or queen or like, yeah.
That's very interesting.
It reminds me of how treaties were viewed. You know, they were viewed as how to get along and how to share resources and, you know, leave plenty for future generations. That's how Native people viewed them. And the other folks that signed them on the other side had a different view of them. It was about, you know, control.
Yeah, kids stories. I feel like, you know, some of the cartoons our kids watch are really about king or queens or
getting all of the wealth for yourself.
Or how to be first. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to something, Morgan, you said a story you were working on around child welfare and this April Dawnland Signals show. We featured ICWA because the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, one of their recommendations was around better trainings for state caseworkers. So we had members of the ICWA work group, the tribal state work group, come in, and it's a very timely issue now because of the en banc hearing that happened with ICWA's. You know, it's probably going to go to the Supreme Court. But I was, you know, I really appreciate having a contemporary Native perspective on those issues too. You know, it's as important as sharing our traditional stories, because you're crap, you know, it's almost like you're creating a story that will be passed down to help our people in the future too. I mean, all of you are. Can you talk a little more about that? I say it because I think of the archives of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There's at least 90 stories of Wabanaki people sharing their experiences in child welfare. And I thought maybe that might be a source for you for research for your book.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I'll have to get some, I'm going to email you after. I want to get some links from you anyways. But yeah, I know like the general legal parameters around, you know, ICWA and, you know, like the Holyfield case and, you know, all of, I guess, and what's occurred in Maine and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I know like at the surface level, and like, so I do need to research and dive into that stuff and figure it out and how it plays into the characters or and how the characters are shaped by, you know, the real nonfiction stuff. But for me, I mean, in a personal way, you know, I was never in, you know, foster care, but I have family members who have, you know, bounced back and forth between families and stuff. And I know what that does and what that can do to children. And so the book I'm writing has three girls, Allison, who's the oldest, then there's Lucy, who's like the middle child, and then there's the littlest one. I can't remember her name, like three or whatever. And it's they each have different attitudes towards their mother. Like the oldest one is very not optimistic about her mom. The middle one loves her mother so much, like she could do no wrong. And then the little one is just like trying to figure it out. And this book, I really want to highlight the intimacy of these relationships between children and parents, particularly mothers, when they are taken from them and put in different homes, even with another family member, because those things have consequences.
Yeah, I think it's really important, Morgan. I really appreciate that because, you know, there's a call, just like there's a call to defund police, there's a call to to dismantle and rebuild the child welfare system. And because separating a child from their parent is really, you know, it damages them. It traumatizes them in, you know, even if it's from a neglectful abusive situation, that separation is harmful. So I appreciate that work you're doing. And I look forward to reading it and helping you in any way I can.
Thank you. Yeah, I really appreciate that.
How about, did I miss the same question for Gabe or Suzanne? What was the question you had posed, Esther?
Oh, I had just asked, we were talking specifically about the book that Morgan had written around child welfare. But we're at 11:02. We have about, 9 minutes left?
Yep, 9 minutes left. Just wondering if, you know, anyone has any closing thoughts that they want to share, anything that we didn't ask you that you wished we had.
You plug your book again if you want.
Yeah.
I know we have to learn to be better at that. That part is like, we're so used to not talking about the things we do too much.
I know. Yeah.
Supposed to be humble, right? It's hard. It's hard when you two have so much going on, I'm sure. So also, what else do you do besides write books? You want to talk a little bit more about your work?
What doesn't she do?
What doesn't Gabe do? That's what we do to each other. Yeah, so we are working to increase access for Wabanaki cultural gatherers for sweetgrass and brown ash, and addressing or trying to work through and create tools to help manage the, well, respond to emerald ash borer, right? There's an invasive beetle that's coming. It's already in Maine, but it devastates ash trees and brown ash in particular. And so I work to help with a group of a lot of other people, a lot of wonderful people, to help create tools to respond to that from a that focus on Indigenous needs specifically. Yeah, so from that, we're like, we have a brown ash door in our heads. That's not on paper. yeah, like all of these things we do, it feels like it can translate so much into a story now. We see the way it translates to a story. And also, I want to say, as beginning storytellers or writers in this, we actually had to Google search a lot of tools and techniques.
Yeah, that's true. The formula of how to tell a story from a child's point of view, and sort of like, you know, yeah, there was a whole bunch of research in that way.
It was just a lot of good pointers. Just a lot of like having the child be the action of change, right? Sometimes you tell a story from a top down, like a parent perspective.
Yeah.
But really work at having the voice of the child be the story and their experience. That was really number one, really. That's what the key thing for us is to think through.
Ensuring that, your main character in a children's story is the child, and that things aren't happening to them, that they are actually helping to create their own story.
Wow. That's wonderful. I think of how useful these books will be for teachers who are in the system complying with the Wabanaki Studies Law, you know, more quality products for them to use in their classroom. Will you have accompanying study guides, do you think?
No,
so far there's like a section in the back of the book that talks about some of the, like, the language. So we have peppered through the book, we have Passamaquoddy Maliseet language, and then some stuff that describes, you know, the practices and things like that. So
the back matter.
Yeah, the back matter of the story, which is something that Tilbury House does in, like, I don't know if you've heard of Clues Basket, or, you know, they've published a couple of other ones that, where they have like the philosophies or the ideas that are introduced in the story are sort of like fleshed out a little bit more. So it is a little bit of a, you know, accompanying thing, but it's not a separate study guide.
Wonderful. Morgan, as we're winding up here, do you have any last thoughts you want to share and talk about your book again?
My book, Night of the Living Res. It always feels weird having to like self-promote. But Night of the Living Res, coming out in fall 2022, it doesn't have, I don't know if study materials will be available for it. I know my publisher said something about like a book group thing, you know, in the back of books that'll have like for book group or whatever, and everyone's sitting there drinking coffee and talking about the book. So I don't know what type of questions will be in there. But yeah, the book coming out, I hope the book challenges notions of what Indigenous literature is or is supposed to be. I think when you publish in a mainstream publisher, they try to twist your work in a way that fits a white person's image of what a Native person is. So it sells. I think that landscape is like changing. So I'm glad that my book, I'm able to write how I want to write it. And I haven't done edits yet with my editor, who is fantastic. And I'm with a smaller press, so I won't be like, have some huge corporation being like, no, you have to make this Native person dance in the scene or something. You know what I mean? Like, to appeal to non-Native readers. But I hope when the book comes out, everybody really likes it.
I can't wait.
Same here.
So we have just three more minutes while we're winding down. And so while we were talking, so much was said about learning from other people. These are not our stories. These are our ancestors' stories. Esther sharing about her mom's writing. Morgan, what stood out for me was when you said to be an artist is to want to help other artists. And so I just wanted to acknowledge all of those that came before, so many wonderful Wabanaki authors and storytellers. And so we're going to close by reading a short poem, and then we will begin to sign off. Esther, did you want to read something for us?
Yes, this is a poem by Sipsis, late Penobscot artist and writer and poet, from her book Prayers, Poems, and Pathways. It's called I Am a Human Being. I am a human being. I come from the humus, the earth, from the intricate loving thought. I gave myself birth. No organization, no government, no body politics sponsored me. Yet here I walk and talk and sometimes sing the same melody. Oh, tis great the creation of earth, of you and of me. Yet what greater tune our earth will sing when we sing the very same melody. I am a human being. I come from the humus, the earth. Into pain and hunger and cold, I gave myself birth. No engines, no machines or windmills assisted me. Yet here I live and love and work on earth's poetic melody. Oh yes, it is great the creation of earth, of you and of me. Yet what larger work we have, even those lullabies to free. I am a human being. I come from the humus, the earth, around anguish, anger, and stirred up dirt. I gave myself birth. No president, no pope, no sitting bull appointed me. Yet here I shiver and shake a state, a spiritual melody. Oh, great the creation of earth, of you and of me. Yet greater understanding, if simple, our tune could be. I am a human being. I come from the humus, the earth. Inside me marks the cycle of time I have from birth. No clock, no watch, no sundial shadows my time. Yet here I march and eat and sleep to the same white chime. Oh, what greatness is the creation of the earth, of you and of me. Yet what greater time we all will have when measured equally. I am a human being. I come from the humus, the earth. Across the sad and desolate plain, I gave myself birth. No sinking ship or burning estate or falling star accompanied me. Yet here I speak of hope and love and sing with humility. Oh, tis great the creation earth of you and of me. Yet what bigger smile our faces become when you love me. Wow.
Thank you.
So beautiful.
Thank you to our listeners for joining us on Dawnland Signals. Thank you so much for our special guests, Wabanaki authors Morgan Tulte, Suzanne Greenlaw, and Gabe Frey. Thank you to our volunteer technician, Jeffrey Hotchkiss. Be sure to join us next month and every third month for more Dawnland Signals and Conversations of Truth, Healing, and Change.